ComC is your home to buy, sell, and flip all the hottest trading cards. Are you tired of spending hours listing cards for sale? Well, ComC Marketplace is the easiest place to sell cards online. ComC will identify, scan, list, store, insure, package, and ship. Just send them your cards, and they take care of the rest. All you have to do is set the price. Visit ComC.com today to start selling your cards. You're listening to the Wax Pack Hero Sports Card Minute, a podcast where we discuss both the hobby and business sides of collecting. I'm your host, Mike Summer, and I want to help you buy, sell, and trade your way into a collection you'll love. Today, I am going to share a conversation I had with Zan Morning from the Wrestling with Cards show. He invited me on for an interview for one of his live streams a few weeks ago, and I wanted to share that conversation with you today. We spent some time catching up and talked about a variety of different topics. I hope you enjoy it.
At the end of last year, last fall, November, I kind of shut down the shop within a shop that I had been doing for the last 3.5 years. And good reasons, it's all good, but that allowed me to free up some time and change my approach on a few things that I've been doing. And so I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit more. But that's been kind of one of the big things that has changed for me.
Yeah. And when I heard you saying that, I was like, oh no, I want to break down more of that, because as a reseller myself, I wouldn't say I was hesitant, but from an outsider perspective, I bet a lot of people are like, oh, Mike's getting out of it. He was part of that crew that came in just to do the quick flip. And now that the mark, you know, and I don't think that's the case, but I would like to break that down more. I've also seen some different things you've been collecting, which we're going to talk about that. The Norman Smiley Super Collection continues to build. And I want to touch on that too, because even though I'm like old man screaming at the clouds about how fun super collecting is and how it just kind of unlocks a different way to collect, I just don't think a lot of people understand that. So maybe, you know, we'll get your opinion on that, but let's go back to the store within a store. I'll just kind of lay out for a minute and let you give kind of a, I know you've talked about this on your podcast, which everybody watching this, make sure to go check out the Wax Pack Hero podcast. Great stuff. And I'll just lay out for a minute and let you kind of talk about what went into closing it and ultimately why you decided to do that.
Yeah. So I think it's important to take a step back and lay out what that really was, right? Some people hear, oh, you shut down your LCS, and yeah, they are just like, oh, there's another LCS that closed. But I think it's important to take a step back and talk a little bit about what this was, because it was a little bit unique. And I think it's a great case study for others out there throughout the country who may want to consider doing something like this. And so to start with, this was a part-time venture for me, something that I was doing in addition to my normal 9-to-5 job, right? And along with that, that meant that I didn't want to take on the full weight of having my own standalone physical location. And so what we ended up working out is I had dedicated space, several hundred square feet of dedicated space within an existing LCS in our town, somebody that I had a pre-existing relationship with. But I had my own area within the shop that was only open when I was there. They didn't sell my merch or that merchandise, you know, on my behalf when I wasn't around. So we had this dedicated space, a shop within a shop is what we called it. Part of that agreement was that I didn't sell new wax and I didn't sell new supplies. So we weren't directly competing on some of that new product. Sure. I was primarily selling singles, and I had hundreds of thousands of cards available there for singles. And so that opened up in the summer of 2020. In the midst of COVID, as businesses were starting to be able to open back up, that's when I bought out an existing shop who was doing a similar thing in that area or in that era, and took over that inventory and started to run the shop within the shop from the middle of 2020 up through last November. And essentially what it came down to is that meant I was doing something pretty much 7 days a week, my day job Monday through Friday. And then I was in the card shop on Saturday and Sunday afternoons. And so for 3.5 years, pretty much 7 days a week, I was going. In addition to the stuff I was selling online, the blog, the podcast, and all of the content that I was creating. And it kind of just got to a point where I was kind of ready for a little bit of a break. You know, my girls are in junior high and high school now, and so their activities were starting to increase. And I just want to be able to spend more time doing some of those types of things as well and take back control of the time and when I was going to be spending time on both the collecting side and the business side that I was going to continue. And so it just worked out well. The shop that I was subleasing from, he was continuing to grow and has continued to grow, and he needed the space, to be honest. And so he was more than happy for me to step aside and let him kind of take that space back over. And so it was financially, it was a super successful 3.5 years. It taught me that I would be able to do it. I learned a ton of skills when it comes to negotiating and acquiring inventory and all of the things that go with having a physical shop. But it also kind of showed that I don't know that I would want to rely on that full time, having a physical shop full time. I really enjoyed the flexibility that comes from selling online. And so I've kind of pivoted my business back to selling online as that primary source of selling. And so I'm back to selling online. I'm back to blogging more, and the podcast is still going. Yep. So it was a great 3.5 years, had a lot of fun, made some money. But now for the last few months, I've had my weekends back, and it's been enjoyable to do that as well.
I think that's a major thing that I want to talk about is the value of time, because I think different people are going to have different perspectives on that, and it reflects in the hobby. Real quick, a couple of shout outs. ZA Champion, he's always here. Welcome. Thank you. And Miami Mark is always here. Thanks for stopping by as well. If you guys have questions for Mike or myself or just anything in general, we can get to it. Leave it in the chat, in live chat. So touching on the time, I think there, as you've seen, there's people that not only have gotten out of selling, and that's, and that could be even selling online, breaking online, selling on whatnot, sick of eBay fees, you know, we've heard it all. And I think a lot of that is they say it's not worth their time, but here you're talking about time from a different perspective, and that's the time that you can get back for your own personal stuff. So would you say that, I'm assuming this is a yes, but you know, I want clarification. As somebody who's continuing to move closer to doing full time, obviously I'm doing it online, but would you say that this is something that is still viable for somebody who wants to do it full time? If, you know, because I'm personally like, I have a regular job currently that I'm working like 40 hours a week. With the additional eBay work, I probably put in an additional 40 hours a week, but I don't have kids. I don't have anything outside of, you know, doing what I do on eBay. Like that's, and the videos, that's become like my favorite thing to do. So from a time perspective for me, like, you know, oh, well, is it worth your time? Well, yeah, because it's what I love doing. Like, you know, I love sorting and shipping and all those mundane tasks that I've talked about a million times before, but a lot of people don't. And like you said, you'd rather have your time back with your family than to waste it on some of that stuff. I mean, not waste it, but you know what I mean? So do you think that, what do you think, I guess your perspective of people stopping selling, stopping breaking, do you think it's more so they're not seeing the profits they want because it's not that easy money anymore? Or do you think it's more so people are kind of valuing that personal time more, maybe a combination of the both? And another interesting thing to tie into that is the stuff you were selling, because, you know, I'm pretty sure your shop didn't have a whole bunch of cool display cases and Zion cases with a bunch of, you know, hipster slabs that people, that you're trying to push on people. So I know that's a lot I just threw out there, but kind of just take it from there and talk about however you want.
Yeah. You know, when you think about from, is it worth the time? That's a question that I still get fairly regularly, right? And the short answer is yes. And you ask, do I think it's viable, right? You know, you and I sell a lot of lower end stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is that worth the time? Is it viable to try to run a business with that type of inventory? And I would say absolutely it is. You know, I sell on 3 different online platforms, and for the last 3.5 years had the stuff in the shop. Overall, 2023 was my most profitable year ever.
Because like that's the year where everybody's like, oh, the hobby's dead, market's dead, and here you are.
Yeah, and I've heard the same thing with, oh, you're closing it down, it must not have worked, right? Well,
yeah.
I mean, it was the most profitable year that I've had. Money wasn't the reason that I stopped doing the physical shop, right? So is it viable? Yeah, it's viable. But like we've talked about before, it takes a different mindset and a different approach, right? You have to have a passion for the low end stuff to make it valuable, right? You have to have I've talked about this before, and I think you and I have talked about this, but there's this sense of accomplishment that I get when I take these base and insert cards that many people in the hobby consider worthless junk, not just trash. And I turn that into thousands of dollars a month of revenue and income, right? And there's this sense of accomplishment that I get when I turn somebody else's garbage, what they consider garbage, into a whole bunch of money that either is used for things in my life or is used to add some pretty cool cards to my collection for essentially free. And so if you've got that passion, in addition to the desire to grow a business, and yeah, it's totally viable, but it does take work. You do have to put in some time and effort into getting those things sorted, organized, and listed.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely viable to still have a resell business, whether that's in cards or other merchandise. Having a resell business in this environment is definitely still viable, and it is possible to grow. It comes down to what income level do you need meet your family's objectives and goals and all of that type of thing, and where you want to go from there. But yeah, it's still viable for sure.
You think a lot of people just got out of it, that, you know, whether it was a fly by night, somebody on Whatnot, or maybe it was an LCS that has actually been in business for 20 years. Do you think that potentially they're not doing that anymore because they want a specific lifestyle? And, you know, you're a prime example. You wanted your time back for a different type of lifestyle, but maybe these people had that. I think Gary Vee calls it lifestyle creep. And, you know, during that hobby boom, maybe they, all that money was just there and easy money. And they were, you know, trying to live this lavish life outside of the hobby instead of reinvesting in the business and focusing on that. What do you think about that, Tate?
Yeah, I think there's a certain segment of the folks that came in over the last few years who they were only in it because it was easy money at the time. I mean, there's a couple year period there that no matter what you bought, whatever sport, non-sport, entertainment card, whatever it was, no matter what you bought, it went up in value within weeks or months, right? Like you didn't have to have any level of intelligence at all to make money in the hobby for a good couple of years. There was no strategy. You just bought and then sold it for more. Like it was.
Well, and that happened in the middle of COVID, which people were at home, right? So they had that time. But now that we've kind of, returned to the semi-normal world, a lot of people are working jobs, spending time with their families, going and doing things. That time's not there anymore.
Yeah, I think you've got a little bit of that. I think once it stopped being easy money, you lost some people who were only in it for easy money, right? And that's worked out to our favor in some situations, right? I mean, we don't have complaints about bots scooping up sealed wax and all of these things as soon as it hits online retailers' websites anymore, because you can't scoop it up and resell it for instant profit like you could, you know, for so long. And so that's been a positive thing that's come. But yeah, I think once it got a little bit more challenging, once you had to put in a little more work, once you had to apply a little more strategy to your business, we saw some of these resellers start to go away. And I'm still reselling a ton. It's just online. You know, I've got a huge Comp C store. I've got a huge Sport Lots inventory, and I've got a growing eBay store inventory as well. And so I've just kind of pivoted a lot of what I was doing from that physical shop to online, but I'm able to do that during a time of day, during certain windows of the morning or the evening that fit better with me still being able to do all of these other things with my family, you know, on those weekend hours.
Yeah. It's like the perfect storm of, you know, having time to kind of tinker with your own PC, sell the stuff that you don't want, buy collections, deal with that. And then, you know, like, and then keep your family life separate and continuing to work. So, I mean, it sounds like you've got it kind of dialed in. One comment here, we were talking about Chuckster. He's in the house. Chuckster, welcome. Chuckster says, I need and appreciate low-end sellers like you guys. As a set collector, I can afford to fill in holes in my collection. And that is actually something I wanted to bring up to you, is an unexpected joy that you get out of selling this stuff. I don't know about you. I'm sure you have. I've gotten messages from people that bought like some mid-90s junk wax era base card. And I'll get a message from them saying, this card means this to me, or I've been looking for this card forever, and thank you for giving it to me at an affordable price. I actually just got a message today that said, I'm not looking to do this full time. This was an eBay message, mind you. I'm not looking to do this full time, but I would like to sell the stuff I don't want to keep a self-sustaining hobby. How can I do that? So the fact that I've done this so long, I was able to give him a brief description about eBay standard envelope, thermal label printer, kind of how all that works. These weird, you're able to help people, be it the PC or just general information about anything, selling, buying, whatever, or general information about the cards themselves or sets or parallels or whatever. Have you also experienced that within your shop, within a shop or within online? Or do you have any interesting stories there that the unexpected joys of being a reseller?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's definitely happened, right? And we get that opportunity selling low-end stuff in a way that others don't always get to experience, right? Like the times when people would come into the physical shop and sit there in my quarter boxes and fill up an 800 count box of random Jose Canseco cards, or you know, some of these other guys from the junk wax era that I had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of, and they're able to fill up a box and get them at a great price. And, oh, I've never seen this one before. You know, all of that type of stuff, the fun that they were having filling up boxes and boxes of these low end cards was just super, super fun to see. Right. Or when I had, at the shop, and I still sell online too, in different ways, a whole bunch of factory sets from the junk wax era and, or wax boxes from the junk wax era. And people would, I remember opening these when I was 10, or I remember going to the gas station and picking out packs of these, or my parents gave me this set. I got this same set under the Christmas tree when I was 13. The joy of nostalgia that folks have come or showed when they're putting together some of these things has been fun to see. And that happened in the shop, and it happens online. You know, I sell on sport lots as well, where there's a lot of low end set filler type cards that folks are picking up. And I'll get a message and saying, it's been so hard to find the commons that I needed to fill out this set. I'm so glad I found sport lots. And I'm so glad you have such a big inventory from that set, because I was able to finish it off, and nowhere else online would I be able to find the common cards I need and only have to spend a quarter delivered or whatever it ended up being, right, for them. And that type of thing is a lot of fun to experience. And I've done the same thing as a buyer. You know, I just on eBay last week, I was able to find two Thad Bosley cards from the same seller that I needed. He only has like 60 something cards, and I only need a handful, but I was able to get two of them from the same seller. And he's like, that's cool that you're a Thad Bosley collector. I'm like, yeah, it's weird, but it's fun.
Yeah. And those are good transitions that we'll get into kind of some different aspects of stuff you're collecting. But real quick, we have a question for you from Elbow Sausage. Is it easier and more profitable to sell singles or player lots? I will let you take this one first.
Yeah. So I think the answer is going to be there. I don't know if there is an easier or more profitable, if there is a direct answer to that. I think selling some of these lower end cards as singles can be very profitable, but selling as lots can be more profitable. Selling as a player lot is going to take less time, but you may give up a little bit of the profit on it, but you might be able to get through more of them, right? So there's a give and take of the number of transactions, the time that you spend doing it, but the margins might be different between those two. So it really kind of comes down to how much time you've got available to spend on it, how much research that you want to do, or if it's more important to you to save time and get through volume quicker than bundling things up and selling as a player lot, you know, might make more sense. And so that's a long answer to say it depends, but both are viable strategies.
Yeah, same. I primarily do singles, but occasionally You know, if you're generally, I don't like, I like to keep quantity of things, but maybe I'm not keeping quantity of Burbank. So like, you know, I might have 20 of the same card at any given time. But if I get a, you know, collection that's going to put me at like 45 of that card, I don't need that extra 20. So what I'll do is put that in a bulk box, like a flat rate. And eventually when I get enough cards, I will bulk sell. I know it's not a player lot, but I will bulk sale a flat rate box full of, you know, all wrestling or all baseball or whatever. And I end up maybe making a little bit on that, but that is to kind of clear that inventory out, like you were saying, so I can get more room to get more stuff in. So I'm with you. I think it depends. It just depends on different aspects of the way you want to go about selling, whether it's the volume or trying to, you know, get those margins any certain way. So, and he says, thanks. So there you go. If you, again, if you guys got a comment or a question, let us know in the chat. So let's move on to your wrestling PC stuff. Two different things I want to touch on today, which is probably why everybody's here in the first place. We spoke about, you know, you mentioned Thad Bosley, and we'll get to the Norman Smiley in a minute, but I think there's this, especially in wrestling cards, I've kind of seen this shift, I think, to where people, they just want to talk about newest releases. And it didn't always used to be that way. And here you are. You there's this set that I think vintage guys know. And I think more of the newer collectors may come in and say, Mike, why would you want to collect these things? They're stupid. They're not numbered. They're not shiny. Why would you want to do this? And it just goes to show you, like the people who are buying from your Sport Lots page, they're still looking for stuff that brings them joy, and they don't care about these new releases or whatever. So I'm going to once again kind of lay out and let you talk about these WWF 3D cards that you've been putting together. And I believe you have the whole set or close to it.
I've got about half the set.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. I really kind of owe some of this to you and some of our early conversations that we first had. You know, you turned me on to the Carnation cards, yeah, you know, that came out in the 80s. And as I kind of explored other kind of weird oddball type stuff from that era, the 3D cards from Topps, they were essentially just a test issue. They were another one that stood out to me as being something different and something unique. You know, there was a baseball version of that product that I had in the shop. I'd even had some packs of them in the shop. And when I saw that there was a wrestling version as well, with a ton of the guys that I grew up watching, that fit right into that window of wrestling that I was more passionate about, that I had more nostalgia when I look back at that era of wrestling. And then I found out how hard and difficult these Topps 3D cards were to track down and to find. That just made them even more interesting, right? Like, I'm a firm believer that scarcity can add to the appeal of a collection, but cards like these 3D cards, they're truly scarce. They're truly scarce because not that many were made. They weren't scarce because some manufacturer decided to make them a slightly different color and slap a serial number on there, which just kind of is fake scarcity, right? There's nothing different about it other than they put a serial number on it and change the color. These are actually really scarce. There's not that many of them that are out there and were ever out there. Sure. So that is a lot of fun to me to try to track these down. So yeah, I had them on my watch list. They've always been on an eBay watch list. And at some point last year, somebody listed a whole lot of six of them, you know, with the original wrappers and everything. And I made an offer right away and scooped up that lot. There's about, I think there's 12. There's 12 total. And I was able to track down six of them in this lot. They don't come up very much. There's a couple that are out there now that have been graded. And I think people are asking like $400 to $1,000 a card for some of these. Now that's not a realistic number. That is a pie in the sky asking price. They're not worth $400 to $1,000 a card. But they do have some value. So I'll be keeping my eye open for some of the others that I need, but it's one of those that's cool. The only thing that I'm not thrilled about with them is they are a little bit oversized and they do have the 3D kind of embossed bubble type thing. So they're not easy to store and display, which is maybe a little bit of the downside or the bummer of them, but they're, I don't know. I just find them pretty cool. So I'm pretty happy that I was able to track down those first six, and I'll be keeping my eye out for the rest.
So going back to, you know, let's talk a little bit about the scarcity. And, you know, I'm a, you know, modern carrying cross collector. I love modern wrestling cards. That's like my modern guy. I super collect. So I love parallels. I love one of ones and golds and all that stuff. But, well, you're right, though. Like, you know, if you go back, and I'm on the flip side, I'm having the same problem with signed wrestling all-stars. There's just there's talent in that set that they're, most of the time it's when they're deceased, but there are some that are active that just don't sign. So trying to, you know, catch some of those to complete that set is really tough to do. And it's not that, you know, there's a crew out there that's super supportive of modern, and they'll say, oh, you know, wrestling all-stars, they're mass produced, not real cards, out of mag. There's a bunch of them out there. I'm like, yeah, but try to find one signed. You know, it's the same concept of what you're talking about here. There's just not that many. So while those cards may be not numbered and they may not grade well, because I know there's a lot of PSA 10 snobs out there, it's still hard to find. And it really does create that rarity and scarcity, which then reflects the price that I have to shell out to get those things into the set. So, you talked about about the talent. So what is it for you that, I guess, kind of spurs that interest to track these down, as opposed to, oh, well, I'm going to go after a gold run of a wrestler I want, or I want to go after a one of one? Like, just from your personal taste of collecting and experience, what's kind of the difference for you there?
Yeah, you know, you and I talked about this a while ago, and Tony was in that conversation too, I believe. And I was talking about how I have a strong connection to wrestling, but it's from the era of the mid 80s through the late 90s, you know, through that kind of towards the middle end of the Attitude Era. And those are the years where I was watching weekly, and I was always watching. And those are the wrestlers that I was a fan of and enjoyed watching, was entertained by, but I had not had that same connection. And I don't have that same connection with the modern product that is currently on TV. And we were talking about how I was having trouble connecting. I wanted to collect some wrestling cards, but I was having trouble connecting and finding my lane within the wrestling card world. And you guys were like, well, who did you really like? And then why not go after that stuff? Right.
Yeah.
And so I thought back to that, and I started to identify some of those people. And then I thought about the other sports and how I enjoy collecting oddballs and food issues and some of those promotional type cards of the other sports. And that pushed me or pointed me towards what I could start pursuing and trying to track down in the wrestling card world. And so that was Quaker Dips. That was these 3D cards. That was some of the Canadian Hostess stickers. The Swanson stuff from Canada that was in the TV dinners up there. You know, there's a whole host of these oddball food issue type things that also feature some of the my favorite wrestlers from the 80s. And then when I moved into the Attitude Era, there was a few things like, I didn't want to start a Stone Cold Super Collection, even though he was one of my favorites, but I did want to pick up the Stone Cold auto, you know, one of his first auto that was on a card. And so I picked up a Stone Cold auto, same thing with the Rock. I picked up the Comic Images Rock auto, and have one of those in my collection. And I said, you know, it would be fun to do a super collection as well. And so which of those wrestlers, you know, am I passionate about? And that led to the most modern part of my wrestling collection. And that's my Norman Smiley collection, where I do have a ton of rainbow type serial numbered, trying to get all of the different, you know, versions of some of the different cards that he's been on over the years. That's the most modern piece, but Norman Smiley of all things is kind of the wrestler that I have a super collection of.
So before we get into Norman Smiley, let's talk a little bit about balancing, because you just gave a great example, and it's what I do too. Like, my main focus for PC stuff is the Carrying Cross super collection. Literally, you could see an hourglass behind me. That's a WWE-branded official product that when he made his recent comeback, like, they never did anything with it, but he confronted Roman Reigns, and they put an hourglass right in front of him and turned it upside down. And then they started selling these. Obviously, I'm probably, like, the only person to buy it. But it's part of the super collection, because I've expanded it out, and we'll talk about super collecting in a minute. But So Karrion Kross, signed Wrestling All-Stars. I'm still putting that set together. But then I do what you did. You know, I'm like, Sting and Ric Flair, that's the first at Clash of the Champions. That's the first match I ever remember watching. So I've got from that same year, I've got a 1988 Wonderama Sting and an 88 Wonderama Flair that are both signed. So that's like kind of the one-off that doesn't fit Karrion Kross or Wrestling All-Stars, but I'm able to keep it in a collection without like saying I'm going to super collect Flair or super collect Sting. What has been the, like, has super collecting, like, before we talk about it, has it kind of put more focus to allow you to add those, not entire sets, but like those one-off pieces that you talked about? For me personally, I found it's a good balancing act that keeps me from going too far down a rabbit hole of The Rock, of Steve Austin, of Triple H, or whoever, because my focus is the super collection, but it does allow me to kind of do the one-offs here and there. So I hope that makes a little bit of sense, but I'll let you kind of give your opinion.
Yeah, it's been good. There's a couple key focuses that I've got from a wrestling perspective that we've talked about, and I've got my saved eBay searches and things like that for those. There's a few other entertainment and, you know, non-sports ones, Stranger Things. I'm a big Stranger Things collector. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to track down, you know, a copy of all of the 2018 Stranger Things. I've got the set, the inserts, all of that stuff. Now I still have a few of the autos that I don't have yet, right? But I've got those safe searches set. From a baseball perspective, I'm building some vintage sets, but I'm narrowed in or have a pretty narrow focus on the couple of those sets that I'm working through. And so I've got that defined list of things that I'm searching for, and I've been able to kind of stick with that as things come up. And it's helped, like you said, keep me from getting distracted on the other things, which has been good because a lot of the things that I'm still needing are not cheap things. And so it's letting those funds build up from my monthly sales to have in those in PayPal or my, you know, eBay payments ready to go to be able to purchase them when they do finally pop up. And I haven't, you know, drained that PayPal account on something that I'm not really quite as interested in, but, you know, was distracted by. Having that focused collection or those few things that I really want to keep as front and center on my want lists and on my watch lists, that has helped me be more focused, and it has helped me actually acquire them as they come up because I don't have to worry about having the funds available because I've been able to kind of stockpile some funds ready to go when those things do pop up.
All right, let's talk about super collecting in general, and we'll start before we talk specifically about Norman Smiley and kind of that approach, just super collecting in general. I don't know if you want to say that you started this with Thad Bosley, like, you know, way back in the day, but for me personally, my first like focus on collecting I can remember was Shaquille O'Neal and Dennis Rodman in the early to mid 90s. Like, those were my two players. I wanted as many cards as I could get from those. And it was kind of interesting that it kind of foreshadowed what I do now. I would get boxes of, like, you know, 95 Collector's Choice and Fleer Ultra and stuff like that. And any Rodman, Shaq, those are put aside. Anything else I was trying to take to school with me to trade for Shaq and Rodman. Fast forward to today, that's what I'm doing with Karrion Kross. Like, that's my main focus. And it's really cut down for me personally on that shotgun approach that, we just talked about it, keeping that focus. And I think that super collecting in general is something that I would like to see more people do. And that it doesn't matter, you know, we'll talk about who you super collect in a minute as far as like why you would pick the people you pick, Karrion Kross, Norman Smiley. Bro, those aren't good investments. What are you doing? You know, that kind of stuff. But I think it would really help people have more fun in the hobby by honing in their focus instead of taking that shotgun approach. And I kind of draw inspiration from, I don't remember the guy's name, but he's a Cecil Fielder super collector. He's always on Twitter posting stuff. And a lot of these, you know, yourself with Thad Bosley, like there's these sports car collectors that I see on Twitter, and they're picking the most random guys that maybe didn't even play that much, or maybe, you know, their average sports fan doesn't even have a clue who they are because they were like a second string tight end or something. But there's that connection with that talent that then all of a sudden, for me personally, I'd like to hear your opinion on this, the aspect of the collection and the act of collecting within super collecting outweighs anything else because of how much fun you're having with that. So I'll lay out a minute and let you take that over.
I've had a lot of fun with it, you know, and the guys that I've picked are guys that don't have a gazillion cards, right? You know, on my podcast, I've been doing a super collector series where I've been interviewing people over the last couple of years. And, you know, some of them have picked modern current active players to super collect.
Me, where there same are here.
Tens of thousands of cards that are out there for these people. That I think would be a little bit overwhelming. You know, Thad Bosley played essentially from the late 70s through the late 80s. And, you know, there's only 60 or 70 cards of his that are out there. Same thing with Norman Smiley. You know, he only had two or three, I think, cards from his active wrestling days. And everything else was post-wrestling days. And until this 2023 Elite set that's coming out here in a week or two, he hasn't had anything since 2018, I think.
Is he in and the so new set? I haven't looked at the checklist.
He has an auto in the new Elite set coming out. And so there's going to be five versions of that as an auto. He doesn't have a base card. And so there's
that's
not
so cool to hear.
Parallels, but he's making his Panini debut in 2023 Elite. And awesome. So that'll be the first new cards that I have to track down, but I've been kind of relieved, right? Like if he had 45 Prism parallels to track down from the Panini Prism releases these last couple of years, I don't know that I would like that or be as excited, but I've had a lot of fun tracking them down. And again, it's been manageable because it's only a few times a year that one of these random, you know, Norman Smiley printing plates comes up for sale, you know, it randomly will pop up. And so it's helped it stay affordable and attainable, but it's fun. It gives you some focus and, you know, the, some of the money that I've spent on some of these guys that don't have quite the same name recognition, some people would just shake their head at of spending $40 or $50, $60 for a card of somebody who is essentially a common or sometimes is a forgotten wrestler. Some people would just shake their head.
Yeah. And that's fine. Let them shake their head. Cause we're over here having fun and continuing to do what we do. And like, you know, to me, sometimes you can find a, let's just say I'm going to make something up here. You need a card out of to complete a rainbow in a super collection. And let's say it's numbered to like $299 or something like that. And for some reason, you just can't find it at an affordable price. All of a sudden it pops up and let's say you can get it for like $5. That $5 you spent on that one card to complete that rainbow or add to that PC because you don't have it. Like the joy that you get out of something like that to add to a super collection outweighs to me, like, you know, getting a card back that grades a PSA 10, you're like, oh, okay, well, that's probably going to sell for more. Cool. Or maybe you hit something in a break that is okay. Yeah. That'll sell for $100. Cool. But that $5 that you spend on that one card to go into that collection, for me personally, a lot of times brings me more joy than any of that stuff. Is it same for you?
Oh yeah. Like this last week, it's in the mail right now. There was, you know, I think I'm down to only needing three or four Thad Bosley cards to have every card of his that's been made.
That's awesome.
And one of those that I need was a random like stadium giveaway when he was a coach for the Oakland A's. That was like the Oakland Plumbers Union, Oakland A's team set or something like that. And so you can't find those. They never come up. And so one came up and I think I paid $10 just for the Thad Bosley coach's card or the coach's card that he was on. But I was happy to do it. I'm like, this never comes up. I'm happy to pay $10 for this card because it's the only one that I've ever seen. And I don't know when I'll see another one. And, you know, the same thing with the Smiley collection. I think there's only three cards that I need that aren't one of ones. You know, I get the one of ones when I can, but there's a 2017 Legends blue parallel out of 50 that I've never seen one come up.
Isn't that crazy? Something numbered to 50 and you've never seen it.
And there's another 2017 kind of flagship blue parallel that's numbered to, I think that one's numbered to 99 or numbered to 50 as well. And I've never seen that one come up. And that's, you know, another relatively high serial number. Never seen those come up. But when they do, I mean, all of the other ones, they sell for a few bucks a piece. And I'm sure, you know, if that one came up, I'd probably pay more than I should just to add it to the collection, because I'm trying to get them all. Now, I don't do kind of like your approach. I think with Cross, you get as many crosses as you can have, or as you can find. Duplicates or not, you'll take them. I've still kind of approach it with, I only need one of each of the different versions of these that I've gone after. And so I haven't gone to that method of super collecting where you take anything and everything and just acquire boxes and boxes full, even if they're all duplicates. But I have had a lot of fun trying to get at least one of every card that that these folks have had put out.
Isn't it interesting, all these products you're finding that are numbered to 99 or 50 and they just don't pop up? Mm-hmm. Or base cards that, you know, like the stadium giveaway just doesn't pop up, but it was something that hobby misconception that a lot of more newer collectors that are just buying the modern products, like, oh, it's out of $2.99. You know, it's not even worth having. I'm like, well, sometimes you just can't find these things. Before we touch on more of this, we got a question for you. Mike, did you sell wrestling in your store or online? And if so, what insights do you have on selling those singles?
Yeah, I had wrestling both in the store as well as online. In our area here in Central Illinois, I had some success with the wrestling cards that I had at the physical shop, but I have more success selling it online. Sport Lots is one of the places that I sell a decent amount of wrestling. And part of that is because there aren't as many sellers on that platform that have wrestling listed. And so I'm one of the few stores that has a decent amount of wrestling that is listed on there. And so I do pretty good selling basin inserts, wrestling basin inserts on Sport Lots. I do sell some singles on eBay as well. You know, when I'm digging through value boxes and things at shows, I'll pick up some of the lower serial numbered type stuff, and that I'll put out on eBay and get it listed out there. And so I do sell some singles on eBay as well. But, you know, I don't know that I have anything unique or a different insight of selling wrestling other than the way that I approach selling all of the other cards that I'm selling. But like anything, if you've got something up there that not very many people do, that's going to be an advantage.
Well, there you go, Miami Mark. Thanks for the question. Hopefully that helps. One other thing I want to talk about with the super collecting, and it's, you know, talk about the joy of spending $5 on that card that you need. But something else that I think is really awesome is just the fact that you can focus on this one thing, but yet you're getting ready to experience that with the Norman Smiley Elite coming up. But, you know, there's these upper echelon, and I'll speak for myself with Cross because I know Norman Smiley doesn't have this, but you'll get what I'm saying, that there's this upper echelon of card in the hobby. Superfractor, Black One of One, National Treasures, all these things. Well, I'm able to get Karrion Kross in those cards at what, in my opinion, is an affordable, definitely a fraction of a cost of even those talents in wrestling, let alone that type of card in sports cards. You know, I think I paid $200 or $300 for the Prism Black One of One for Kross's first Prism card. If you go look into even second and third rate players in basketball or football with Prism Black, good luck paying, you know, a couple hundred bucks for that. So and I know you're getting ready to experience that with Panini, but I know you've experienced that with what you just showed off, like a one of one printing plate. If somebody's just collecting 80s wrestling, you can't really say that. So what has been the, like, being able to experience kind of a wide range of, I would say, popular hobby mainstays as far as like one of ones and autos that are certified? And, you know, I can't remember if you have the WCW Norman Smiley auto, but that, like, that set is, like, you know, wrestling lore at this point. Mm-hmm. So how has being able to experience all of these different aspects of important wrestling cards within the history of wrestling and doing that at an affordable price because you decided to super collect somebody that's not The Rock or Steve Austin or Roman Reigns or whoever?
Yeah. So I do have that WCW Smiley awesome. Auto. That was one that I was able to track down. But yeah, like you said, you know, I do have, while there's almost solely one of ones that I still need for the Smiley collection, I have been able to track down a good number of other one of ones, out of tens, out of fives, and those types of things. And yeah, some of those I was able to get for, you know, getting an autographed printing plate for $25, you know,
there you go.
Is fantastic. And I will do that any day of the week. Right. And so, yeah, there with what he does have out, there are still a lot of low serial numbered, harder to find things that if it was, you know, somebody else, it would be a much tougher set to accomplish. Right. But there's still that I've got an almost entire rainbow of some of these things. And that's just kind of neat in of itself. And so I'm in that middle ground where I like things to be a little bit of a challenge, but I don't want them to necessarily be impossible.
Sure.
And so I enjoy some of those things, but the one of ones can get a little frustrating sometimes because there is that one of one and I may or may not be able to get it. There's a guy out there that has the full rainbow of, I think it's the 2018 Topps Legends Norman Smiley print plate autograph rainbow. And we've chatted a little bit back and forth, but he's not all that keen on selling it. And I don't know if I'll ever get it, but it sure would be nice to pick up the whole rainbow all at once. But it's a little bit out of my control. You know, I may or may not ever be able to get those. I don't know. Or some of the stuff that I still need, some of those one of ones or plates, they might still be in a pack someplace.
Yeah.
You know, they may not even have been opened yet. And so there's a little bit of that frustration that comes from that, but it is neat when you're collecting some of these guys that aren't all that popular compared to the big superstars, that you can get them super cheap and super affordable, but you can still kind of have that sense of accomplishment of putting together a rainbow or putting together their full run from a particular set or year.
Yeah. And it's also interesting to see other people's collections. Like, you know, it's cool when you're posting new Norman Smiley stuff, like I'm rooting for you. I love Norman Smiley. It's cool to see it. And then on the flip side, I'll see somebody that picked a modern star on NXT and they don't have that many cards, but you could see the passion coming through that they're putting this collection together. And to me, that's it's a breath of fresh air. And I love seeing it compared to, okay, this guy's got 30 more Hogan cards. Like, we all love Hogan, but you know, there's just something, I guess, different that I like about seeing these oddball different types of super collecting, even like what Bo's doing with the 1 million Cubs. Like, who's doing that? Like, it's just different. And that's what I love seeing. So anything else you want to touch on as far as like advice or anything that we haven't touched on with just super collecting in general? Because I really think that anybody out there, I think somebody should be super collecting, whether it's, you know, a sports card person, maybe it's a team, kind of like what Bo's doing, or a wrestler. Like, if it is Hogan, okay, good luck. But, you know, maybe it is, I don't know, Doink the Clown or something, like something that you can kind of, you know, you have an attachment to, you have a joy with, but it just kind of unlocks this whole new wave of collecting for me. So I'll lay out and let you kind of get the final words on super collecting.
Yeah, I think what you just said, it was what I was going to reiterate. You know, I think the reason that I enjoy my Smiley collection so much is because of the memories that I have sitting around with my friends in college and during the summers in between the years of college, watching the Monday Night Wars and cheering for Norman Smiley when he came on, because it was one of the funniest things that we thought, you know, the way that they had him booked, the people that he was going against and calling him the master of submission moves and all of this stuff, but he lost half the time any, you know, that he was out there. Like, we just had so much fun watching him wrestle in the midst of all of that stuff going on. Those memories are the reason that I enjoy my Smiley collection. And so if you're thinking about doing that, find somebody that you have fond memories of it brings back or takes you back to a time where you are having a ton of fun, whatever it is, have that nostalgic connection to them, because that's what's going to help you enjoy that process even more. The people that I have talked to through some of these super collector conversations or people who maybe lose some steam on that is because they picked somebody because that was supposed to be the hot investment. And so they were going to try to super collect the hot investment, or they were just, this was the guy that everybody was talking about. So they're going to jump on board and try to do the same thing with that same person. But they didn't really have that same passion or connection to that wrestler or to that player. Pick somebody that you're connected to and that you're passionate about. Don't just try to follow the herd.
There you go. Perfect. We'll close out on that. So last thing we're going to touch on is I'll relate it back to, you know, the fly-by-night LCSs we saw closing down that started in 2020. Not yours, of course, but you know as well as I do that content was kind of booming during the pandemic. Like, everybody was having a sports car podcast, and some of those people are still sticking around, putting out, like, and your prime example of that. And some of them have gone by the wayside. So kind of a quick overview before we kind of get into a little bit more content. How has content creation changed for you since the last time we spoke, if at all?
I think the thing that has changed is I've had the time now that the shop is closed to be able to dig in and go a little bit more back to my roots of content creation. And so I started creating content back in 2017 with waxpackhero.com and the blog. And I did that because I wanted to share some of the experiences that I had coming back to the hobby after not collecting for a while, so that others who were returning to the hobby would be able to get up to speed a little bit quicker, right? I wanted to share about some of the sets or the players or the cards that I was collecting, especially because of my focus on oddballs and some of the weird stuff out there that isn't available everywhere, or information about it isn't available everywhere. And so I wanted to write about that, so there'd be a resource for people who might want to look into the same thing. And so I started blogging back in 2017, and that's how I got my feet wet in creating content and sharing knowledge and helping educate and trying to give back a little bit to help others who are able to learn, you know, who would be able to learn. And then eventually kind of moved into podcasting, and I've been having the podcast weekly. I don't think I've missed a week since I started in December of 2019. And so that's been consistent. But once I opened up the store, blogging went from 4 or 5 articles a month down to 1 a month, maybe sometimes 1 every 2 months. And since I stopped, I've been back doing 5 or 6, 7 articles a month now for these last few months, and being able to put a little more focus on to some of that written content that I was producing before. The podcast is still going. I'm still kind of doing the same, you know, maybe I'll have an episode where it's just a single topic of me discussing something. And then I'll have a couple episodes where I'm interviewing a collector, or interviewing another, you know, somebody else in the industry, or another content creator, something like that. And that's been fun. I don't know if there's a limited audience, I feel like, for the type of content that I put out. It's not blowing, you know, the numbers don't blow things out of the water. Some of there are far more popular content creators than me, right? There's hobby personalities that have started creating content over these last couple of years that have far surpassed anything that I put out when it comes to numbers, and it's very different content with a very different focus than what I'm doing, and it's resonating with a lot of people. And some of the stuff that I put out doesn't resonate with as many people, but it's true to who I am and what I'm passionate about and what I believe. So I've kind of stuck with some of the same styles of content that I've done this whole time, but it hasn't necessarily turned me into the most well-known or the biggest creator that's out there. And so I guess you can take that for what it is, but that's how things have gone for me in my kind of content creation journey from 2017 to today.
Let's talk about the blog for a minute. People may be asking, Mike, it's 2024. What the heck are you doing with a blog? And I still think there's value in, we'll call it text-based content. And the two examples I have is obviously your blog and Brett McGrath's email that he sends out that, you know, periodically. And those are things that I'll either keep a tab open with your blog And, you know, I may not like be able to read every one of them as soon as they come out, but I have them. So if I'm, you know, sitting somewhere trying to kill some time, guess what? Whip out the phone, read the blog, whip out the phone, read that email that Brett McGrath sends out. And there's just this advantage to having that option that, you know, if I'm in that same situation, I probably can't just throw on headphones and listen to a podcast, or watching a YouTube video may not be as nice based on what's around me. You know, if I'm in a family event, there's a lot of noise or something like that. So how has just blogging from a type of because not a lot of people are doing blogs anymore. How has that been from you from a creative standpoint, and just kind of how the fulfillment has been for you on that since bringing it back?
A lot of what I'm sharing is I view it as reference material for the hobby, you know, and tips and guides and tricks, right? So some of the most popular articles that I have are how to safely send cards in a PWE, right? You know, there's hundreds of people a month that come and read that article on the website. The ultimate guide to shipping cards, you know, so not just a handful, but more, you know, that is super popular. I have one of the segments of my site is a first Bowman checklist. So people that collect baseball cards and baseball prospects, they can come to my first Bowman guide and do a search and find out what Bowman set had somebody's first Bowman card. And that's one of the most popular sites that I have. I've got the WWE Topps Living set because I enjoyed that. And so I've got stuff on that. And then if you do a search on certain oddball type things, my article on that set on waxpackhero.com is the number one Google search result, right? And so there's still a demand for some written reference type content. If you want to just show off your hits, if you want to show off the, you know, your recent mail day and that type of thing, yeah, Twitter and Instagram and all of those types of social media platforms, that is a much more timely resource to be able to kind of show off a card or those types of things. But if you want to learn about a set, if you want to see kind of a checklist or reflect back on something like that, be able to have something to reference, the blog or the website, is there's still value to having content like that that's out there. I've seen success as I've ramped it back up and I've started to create more. I've seen the traffic start to increase again to the blog. I enjoy having it there as a reference point, you know, in the future, you know, for people to look back on, and for me even to reflect back on, to say, what was I thinking about back in 2018? What was my mindset like back then? That's been good. I enjoy the written form as one of those pieces of content that I want to keep creating.
Something as you were talking about that I just thought of, and that could be the importance of having specifically the written, but you could just say this with content in general. You know, for the longest time, a lot of like hobby stuff was on message boards, and that seems like that's kind of migrated into different forms of social media. But as we kind of see the message boards go away sometime, or websites go away, sometimes that information is lost to history. So, you know, I think you're doing a service to the hobby by even just, you know, talking about how to ship a card PWE. There's you could probably find other people doing that, but that doesn't matter. It's the fact that you're putting something out there that's useful to the hobby that, you know, could stay there, especially if it's, you know, on a blog post that you don't delete. It could stay there for forever. And that could be a very useful resource in a time where everything seems to be changing to, you know, lightning fast, instant access kind of stuff, which can sometimes get lost.
There's still so much to learn. Part of what is fun and frustrating at the same time with content creation is knowing what's going to resonate with people, right? Mm-hmm. And how to navigate, you know, the different platforms. You know, I turned to that article that I wrote about how to ship in a PWE, you know, around that same time, I did a video tutorial on my YouTube channel about that. And, you know, like that PWE video has like 23,000 views on my YouTube channel.
That's good.
By far the most popular video that I've ever put out there. But my interview with Drake Magruder, you know, big wrestling collector, had a lot of fun, shared some good insights. That has 18 views or something like that, right? And so
crazy.
Why I don't know. You know, why does that? Why have 18 people watched that interview with one of the more well known collectors in the hobby? 18 views, but my 5-minute video on how to ship in a PWE has 23,000. I don't know the answer to that, right? Like, so, you know, some of the stuff that I put out, like, sometimes it feels like I'm just doing it for myself and 16 other people. But then every once in a while, you've got something out there that, that really resonates and takes off and people find value in. So, you know, I think again, when it comes to content creation, you have to share about with things that you're passionate about that you find valuable and hope that others do too, but there's no guarantee that that other people are going to care what you're doing. And so you've got to care yourself and find enjoyment in the creation process.
Yeah. And hopefully what you just said can be some good inspiration for anybody watching this live or watching this on the replay of maybe they want to start a podcast or a blog or a YouTube channel or whatever it is. You know, maybe that just keeping in mind that, sure, you're probably going to help people along the way, which you said something that'll be our last question here. But also you're doing it for yourself because I've always said it's a fun creative outlet to do. And if you've got something you want to say, you can have your own platform now that what you say may resonate with other people. It may not. But the fact that you're, you know, a person has the capability of doing that now for free or whatever is really cool, in my opinion. And that kind of leads me, as you were talking, to the last question of content creation. I actually didn't have this thought out, and as you're talking, like, light bulb went off. And that is the way that me and you approach reselling a lot of the lower end stuff. Occasionally, we, you know, we'll get something big. I kind of think that's the same way with content. I feel like obviously we want to make money on ads or sponsorships or however we can, because that's a nice bonus. But the more I do this, the more I feel like it reflects a similar aspect of my sales where I'm catering to a specific audience, but if I'm not catering to that audience, nobody else is going to. And that's, you know, with the low end selling, that's kind of how I feel about this. I mean, go right now. You can go check out wrestling card content. There's not a lot of it out there. There's some, but not a lot. Like there's, so I feel like if I don't do this, you know, it's just going to, that information, whether it's got the 18 views, well, you know, I have videos like that that don't have very many views, but the views that I did get, maybe those select few people, it really helped them out in some way, shape or form. So now that I've put that out there, do you kind of see the resemblance?
Yeah, I think so. Right. And I think back to when I first got started and nobody knew who I was and no one paid any attention to those types of things. And gradually that audience grew over time. I think, and from a website perspective, it's been pretty consistent. Right. And there's some good traction there. From a podcast perspective, I think there's definitely a rise and fall, and I was fortunate that I started a little bit, like only a few months, but a little bit before COVID. And I was able to also ride some of that popularity wave in the audience of the podcast that didn't necessarily match, you know, or is come back down like we've seen with the overall popularity of cards. And there's so many people out there now, right, creating content that you've seen that come down. But going back to what you kind of said there, one of the things that keeps me creating content and excited about creating content is when I get that email from a collector who said, I had never even thought about selling my low-end cards on sport lots. But just like you, I had a ton of boxes full of base cards that I didn't need anymore. I started listing them on sport lots. And last month I made enough to cover my car payment.
Yeah.
And getting that type of feedback that made a meaningful impact on their life and their family's life, right? That this person is now making enough on sport lots on a monthly basis to cover the cost of their car payment. That excites me. That tells me that at least for that person, I made a positive impact on their life by sharing my experiences, and they were able to utilize some of that to improve their life as well. And that is super meaningful to me. And so when I get those types of stories shared with me from folks who listen or from folks who read the articles, That just means so much to me and makes it worth it. It just makes it so worth it.
Yep, I agree with you. And we'll go ahead and close on that. So before we get out of here, let everybody know where they can find you. I will preface by saying I've got your website in the link in the show notes. So anything you're going to talk about, they can find it at that link. But floor is yours to anything else you want to say and plugs and whatever.
Yeah, thanks for putting that on there. So, yeah, waxpackhero.com is kind of the landing page for the blog articles. The podcast links get put up there. The YouTube channel is linked to there as well. On Twitter, I'm TheMikeSummer, at TheMikeSummer. On Instagram, Threads, and TikTok, I'm WaxPackHero. I try to put out stuff on all of those different channels. So find me, connect with me, send me a note. I'd be happy to connect and hear your story.
And hopefully some people have got Norman Smiley cards you need and they can hook you up with those.
That's right. Let me know if you've got any Norman Smileys and hopefully I can fill in some of those remaining gaps, or if you're going to be opening any Donruss Elite here in the coming weeks and you get any of those Norman Smiley autos, look me up.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of people that are part of this channel that are more modern collectors. So if you guys are going to be jumping in any breaks or you're ripping boxes yourself for personal reasons, you get those Norman Smiley collections, get a hold of Mike. Thanks, everybody, for watching live. If you're watching on replay, let me know what you thought of the video. If you have any additional questions for Mike, you can leave those in the comments. Again, like we said, make sure to check the links in the show notes to Mike's website, as well as all the other ways that you can help show your support for this channel to keep these things going. Mike, good talking to you. Everybody, thanks for joining.